Good. Can I break in and say hello then? My name's Kev Murdoch. I'm the senior minister here at Euston Church. I want to say a special welcome to you if you wouldn't normally be with us on a Tuesday evening. Great to have you with us for this evening's session on the subject of abortion. It's not a subject we've directly addressed much in Sunday teaching. That's partly because it's not a subject that lends itself to short soundbite sermon applications. It deserves to be treated with the appropriate sensitivity and care and the appropriate level of detail, and that's what this evening is about. We're really grateful to Dr. Lizzie Ling for joining us. Lizzie was a family GP for many years, so she's experienced in this area professionally, pastorally, and theologically as well. Lizzie is the women's minister at St. Ebb's Church in Oxford and has co-authored a Christian book on abortion. Lizzie, thank you so much for coming to be with us this evening. In a moment, I'm going to hand over to Lizzie, but just to let you know how the evening will run for the rest of the time, Lizzie will present to us for about 50 minutes, and then there'll be a chance to input questions and comments through Pigeonhole. There's a QR code. I'm going to ask Clarence if you could put the QR code up just now. Clarence, thank you very much. I want to give you the chance to take that QR code now so that as questions and comments come to your mind during the talk, you can submit them as we go along if you would like to. Now, obviously, the subject we're thinking about this evening is not about abstract ideas. It's about the pain and the consequences and the challenges of life in a broken world. For some of us in the room, abortion will be a personal issue, perhaps very raw. So I just want to encourage all of us as we engage with the Q&A later and as we engage with every part of this evening, let's do that in an appropriately sensitive and respectful way towards one another. Lizzie, I'm going to invite you to come and speak to us now. Let's welcome Dr. Lizzie Ling.
Thank you very much. No, it's great to be here. As you said, it's a sensitive, but it's a very important issue. And it's an issue over which there's lots of polarisation of opinion. Can you hear me okay? Is it working, yeah? Okay. And today I think we'll see that it's also a multifaceted and a complex issue. We're really only going to touch on the subject, but I hope today will serve as a good, broad introduction. We're going to think biblically, hopefully constructively and compassionately. And I hope we'll come away equipped to a degree to engage with the issue ourselves, whether that's in discussion with others about the rights and the wrongs, maybe, or whether it's pastorally with those who are considering or have had an abortion. My interest in this topic really began about 6 years ago, crystallized when I wrote the book that Kevin referred to. And writing that book was a real challenge. I might have been a doctor for some time, but I can't say I'd really thought deeply about this issue. But this time I was a Christian. I hadn't been for most of my GP years. And what I was so grateful for was it didn't just firm up what I believed about the rights and wrongs of the topic, but more because I came to see some of the pain and the complexities of the issue surrounding it through the lens of the Bible and against the backdrop of the gospel. The gospel which is good and robust enough to hold an issue as painful, personal and complex as this is. I also came to see the goodness of God's plans for sex and relationships. That's not just in theory, it's worked out in practice in this issue. We make our own mess when we step away from God's blueprint. And we'll see some of that, as I said, worked out as we think about this topic. God's ways in his world really are good. It was so important to me that the gospel could hold this issue. Could we have the first slide, please? You'll see I put it on the slides, I put it in your notes. It offers forgiveness, first and foremost, forgiveness for all, whatever our sexual histories, whether we've had an abortion or not, it offers us forgiveness. It offers justice, justice for the unborn who haven't had a voice. It offers justice for the woman who's had to make a difficult choice in very difficult situations, maybe, for fathers who haven't had a say in whether their son has or daughter has been aborted or not. There is justice in the gospel. There is hope for individuals. There is also hope for the overthrow of underlying systems and structures which make abortion so commonplace in our society. And there's help for those who decide to keep a baby in difficult circumstances, for those who are grieving the loss of a baby, and for those of us who might be walking alongside others who are making difficult decisions or needing counselling in the light of what's happened in their past. So the gospel, I knew the gospel was good and it covered the whole of life, but it's not until you get down to the nitty-gritty of personal issues as difficult as this one that you see the gospel really does hold water. And today I welcome the opportunity to talk in churches about this topic because it is a hidden problem, hidden in our churches. We don't know what's going on generally. We don't know what the stats are, because we don't talk about them and they're horrific. We'll come to some of those. And there is also a huge amount of shame and pain around abortion, silent suffering, particularly in the church where it's seen as particularly shameful. And it is estimated that 1 in 3 women have had an abortion by the time they're 45. 1 in 3 women have had an abortion by the time they're 45. And that's a similar statistic thought to exist in the church. And so the likelihood is that there will be men and women in the room here for whom this topic is very personal. And it's for this reason that I'm going to do most of the talking this evening. We will have a little bit of time when we look at a Bible passage as we turn in sort of threes and fours or whatever to have a look at it. But I hope that will help. Knowing that framework will help any of you who need to feel safe here this evening, that you will be. So let's just remember this next slide, that there is now no condemnation for those who are in Christ Jesus. And let's remember that first and front as we go into this topic now. Let me pray, though, before we go any further. Heavenly Father, please help us here. Please would you meet us at our point of need, whether it's that knowledge of forgiveness, whether that's help along the way. May that, Heavenly Father, it's help to help others. Please would you help us to think biblically, to speak wisely, and to act compassionately in this context. In Jesus' name, amen. Okay, so we're going to start by looking a bit of Bible. We're going to then look at some statistics, some factors that influence those statistics and the reasons behind them, before we touch on how we might be able to help and get involved. So the first bit on your handout, on the slides, the biblical background. It's probably verses that you know well, but let's go back to Genesis. Genesis chapter 1, starting at verse 26. I'm sorry, I'm going to read it in the NIV, but I think you've got ESVs, haven't you? But that's okay. So Genesis 1 from verse 26. Thinking together that we're created by God, we're created for a purpose, and that purpose is unique. So verse 26, then God said, "Let us make mankind in our image, in our likeness, so that they may rule over the fish in the sea and over the birds in the sky, over the livestock and all the wild animals, and over all the creatures that move along the ground." So God created mankind in his own image. In the image of God, he created them. Male and female, he created them. God blessed them and said to them, "Be fruitful and increase in number. Fill the earth and subdue it. Rule over the fish in the sea and the birds in the sky and over every living creature that moves on the ground." So we're here at day 6 of creation. God has just made the animals and he turns to make man. But man is very different from the animals. We notice that man is made in God's image. That middle paragraph, male and female, we are made in God's image. Not like the animals, in God's image, to reflect something of what he is like and to steward the earth. We're created that way, and our value depends on the worth our Creator sets on us. If he says we're valuable, then we must be. If he doesn't, then we're not. That's the Creator's prerogative. And he says we're valuable. The first paragraph refers to our ruling, another word for stewarding the earth, and the third tells us how to do it, by being fruitful and increasing in number. Having children is a fundamental part of being human. Male and female together, they were to be fruitful and increase in number. That's what our bodies are made for. Eggs, wombs, ovaries, penises, testes, and sperm. Our bodies tell us something about our purpose. Now, that's not to undermine anyone who, like me, for whatever reason, has not had children. We are still made in the image of God. Nor is it to undermine all the other wonderful things people do and achieve. But having children is, all things being equal, fundamental to what it means to be men and women. Let's skip over and just have a quick look at Genesis 2, verse 24. And as Adam looks at his wife, he says, "This is my bone of my bones, flesh of my flesh." He's so excited. "She should be called woman, for she was taken out of man." And then verse 24, "That is why a man leaves his father and mother and is united to his wife, and they shall become one flesh." Now, one flesh is reflected in the marriage union, but it's also 23 chromosomes in the sperm, 23 chromosomes in the ovum or egg, and together they make one flesh, 46. That's how it's meant to be. And I wonder whether one of the reasons that this topic arouses such strong emotion and causes such pain is precisely because procreation is so fundamental to our purposes as men and women, and abortion strikes at the very heart of that and makes it profoundly wrong, counter to the most fundamental of God's intentions. So we have an innate dignity and we have a unique purpose. And we're also known intimately by God. And this is where I will get you to turn around into fours or threes or fours or something and just have a little look at Psalm 139. This is often a passage often used when we're thinking about this topic. I'd love you to just scan the psalm, but concentrate on verses 13 to 18. Things that strike you in relation to this topic. Maybe things we learn about ourselves, maybe things we learn about God. And then I'll draw us back together again with a few thoughts. So looking at verses 13 to 18, focus, having scanned the psalm a little bit, what strikes you in relation to this topic? Have a chat with others. Okay, how are we doing? It's an amazing psalm, isn't it? It really talks about David is sort of celebrating the closeness with which God knows him and is aware of him. And the beginning sort of kind of starts in the present, but then he scans back to even in the womb where he was known by God, where he was created by God. And at the end of the verses, which I love as well, at the end of verse 18, "Were I to count them," they would, referring to his days, "were I to count them, they would outnumber the grains of sands," or your thoughts, rather. "When I awake, I am still with you." Now, in the context of that psalm, that's probably a context of going to sleep at night, and when I awake, I'm still with you. But you know what? When the Christians look back on that, there's also another dimension that comes in. We talk about the sleep of death in the New Testament, and when we awake, we'll be in the new creation. There is a sense in which this psalm is talking about a continuum that goes right back from conception through life, through death, to the resurrection life. And even as Christians, Ephesians 1 would remind us that we are known even before the beginning of time. So if from God's perspective, there's a whole continuum of our existence from before time right through to resurrected glory. It's not that life starts at birth. There's a whole much bigger picture, which is so counter our normal sort of framework and ways of thinking. But it's worth remembering that conception to resurrection continuum. And we see it too in the story of Jesus, the example of him. When Mary goes to see Elizabeth at the beginning of Luke, we're told that Elizabeth heard Mary's greeting and she said that the baby, John the Baptist, leapt in her womb. And if you read those verses, it's like the four of them are there. There's four people there, not just two. It's not just Mary and Elizabeth, but Jesus and John the Baptist as well. And there are other references as well where God says to Jeremiah, "Before I formed you in the womb, I knew you. Before you were born, I set you apart. I appointed you as a prophet to the nations." There's an assumption that life begins way beyond birth in the Bible. And why shouldn't we see that things like this? Jesus was incarnate at his conception, not at his birth. And fully man and fully God, he now sits at God's right hand in resurrected glory. He has been where we will go. So there's an assumed continuum in Scripture from conception to resurrection. Let's just pop up. We want to talk a little bit more now about this idea of conception. Because some folks say, is an embryo really a person? Isn't he or she just a clump of cells? Well, on one level, yes, there's a clump of cells, but on another, so much more. As we've seen, unique, loved, and known by God. But others don't see things like that. There are those, though, who think that just because someone is human, it doesn't necessarily mean that their life is worth protecting. Just because they are human, are they a person? And do they have personhood? Somehow, personhood needs to be attained. Rather than just something which is, because of who we are, it's something that we have to acquire or achieve. For some, you achieve personhood or value or worth of life protecting when you are born and you're independent of the mother. But independence of the mother is impossible for a baby. The baby is still dependent on its mother or adults anyway to live. And so a baby cannot be completely independent in utero or out of utero. So where do you draw the line? For others, it depends on a whole host of other factors, such as being rational or aware or able to make decisions and have agency. Does that give your life personhood or value or worth that needs protecting? But that argument too runs into problems. Again, where do you draw the line? What about the disabled? What kind of disabilities that need to be protected? What kinds of disabilities shouldn't? So basically, the argument goes, there are certain criteria that need to be achieved in order for your life to be worth protecting. It's no surprise that the disability lobby find this issue so hard. And it's no surprise, too, this slippery slope can get going. So things that we might think are inconceivable, people talk about. Some advocates of these personhood arguments acknowledge that infanticide, called by some post-birth abortion, might even have a place. I hope you can see how fundamentally wrong this kind of thinking is, because God never operated with us on the basis of our achievements. He says we are loved and we're accepted when we turn to him. We have worth because we're human, and that Jesus saw us valuable enough to come and die for us, to buy us forgiveness. God never implies that somehow our worth depends on our abilities. It's simply conferred on us because we're human, made in his image, the image of the triune God, three persons in one, Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. He has set his love on us, and it's a gospel of grace from start to finish. And so from when is life life? When is it worth protecting? I'd like to suggest that it does need to be from conception. From the time egg and sperm fuse, and new life with all its wonderful potential has been created. People do differ, though, and in the past, Christian doctors have often felt that it's the time of implantation, when the egg and the sperm have fertilized and at the time they implant in the uterine wall. They argue this on the basis that many fertilized eggs don't implant anyway. But babies can sadly be lost at any stage, so that argument, again, like others, is the first stage of a slippery slope. And as we'll see now, as we look at some statistics, slippery slopes are dangerous. So we're going to run through some statistics now so that you know what to expect. And you might not realize, basically, that abortion is legally, abortion is illegal in this country, and it is legally regulated. So the act in question is the 1967 Abortion Act, which allows abortion to take place under certain defined circumstances, and we'll look at some of those circumstances in a moment. But suffice it to know at the moment, it is legally regulated. And one of the legal requirements is that statistics are collated and published by the Department of Health every year. You can Google them, and there are huge, great spreadsheets. And we're going to just pick out some salient features now to get, just to help us get our bearings. So you've got here a bit an overview of 2023. They're the latest statistics that are available. Let's just have a look at the graph at the bottom left first, and you'll notice that the rise in the number of abortions has gone steadily up and is showing no sign of slowing down in this country. And in that year, there were nearly 300,000 abortions in the year. That equates to over 1,000 every working day. That compares to nearly 600,000 live births the same year, which was the lowest since 1977. So for every two live births, roughly, there is one abortion. 42% of the women who had an abortion in 2023 had had one or more before. Most of them were early in pregnancy, so nearly 90% at less than 10 weeks gestation, and just 0.1% over 24 weeks. I find those figures quite staggering, really. I'll come on to that, but I don't expect the people who established the Abortion Act in 1967 imagine this was what would happen. You'll notice on the graph on the right-hand side that there's a general increase, obviously, but the increase is most in the 20s to 30s age group and in the over 30s. Under 16s are sort of slightly on the downwards trajectory. It may be that the increase in the over 30s has got to do with antenatal care and antenatal screening for abnormalities, so that a woman, when she's pregnant, will be offered a whole series of tests to establish the risk of her having a child with a selection of conditions, such as Down syndrome. And based on that risk that she's given of having a child with Down syndrome, she may decide to go ahead with the termination of an abortion, or termination of pregnancy is what it's called in the medical profession. So the sadness of that is that as women are having babies later in life, so more of those tests are being done, and they are coming up with risks, which we're not really very well equipped to deal with risk or to assess a risk. What is a risk in 600? Well, 600 is higher than the average. You might have a higher risk than the average, but it's still a pretty low risk. How do I assess that? It's difficult to know what to do. And women, sadly, are choosing to have an abortion based on the risk without even knowing whether the child has the condition. So there's a whole thing going on in antenatal clinics, which is probably a topic for another conversation, but feeds into why things are rising in the over 30s, because older women are offered more tests because their risk is thought to be higher and they are opting for abortions. The decrease in the under 18s may be related to better sex education in school, but it might also be related to the fact that less are having sex in a sort of person-to-person way, with more online engagement, is the latest kind of suggestions as to why those figures are decreasing. So I said abortion is basically illegal in this country, but exceptions are made under certain situations. And before an abortion is carried out, two doctors have to sign a form saying that in all good conscience, they believe that conditions have been met and that legal exception is justified. So this is the form that they have to sign, and you can't get a very good picture of it at the moment. But basically, there are several categories, A, B, C, D, E, etc., under which abortion can be legally performed. And we know that the majority of abortions in this country, 98% of the abortions in this country, are carried out under Category C. So let's have a look at, closer look at Category C. Next slide. Okay, so this is in legal speak. The pregnancy has not exceeded its 24th week, and that the continuance of the pregnancy would involve risk greater than if the pregnancy were terminated of injury to the physical or mental health of the pregnant woman. So someone's got to make an assessment that the risk of injury to the mother, physical or mental health, is going to be greater if she continues through the pregnancy than if she were to have an abortion. So they decide on the balance of probabilities. And according to the government stats, 99.9%, literally, of cases, it is the mental health, not the physical health, of the woman that was considered at risk. And that is highly subjective. That means that Category C is loose enough to allow for abortion on demand up to 24 weeks. And that is exactly what's happening. It has become an unquestioned choice, a right to have an abortion up to 24 weeks under Category C. And there are repeated political moves to remove this 24-week restriction. Bills come before Parliament regularly, and we need to make sure we're aware of them and that our voice is heard when we have opportunity to express our opinion. Recently, you might have heard in the news, there was the Crime and Policing Bill, and there was quite a lot of misinformation going around in the Christian press, I think, as well as the secular press about what this achieved. I think many of the pro-life camps were worried that this was basically now abortion on demand up to full term. It's not that. The abortion law is still in place. This was a change to the Crime and Policing Bill. But it does mean that women, and I put it on your handouts, are no longer held criminally responsible for ending their own pregnancy, including at home with pills. And any past investigations of women who had managed their own abortions at home are being dropped or pardoned. But it does mean that doctors could be vulnerable to prosecution if they sign or allow for an abortion outside the constraints of the abortion law, which I've just explained to you, then the 24-week limit remains. Although I think most people feel that it's very unlikely any doctors would be prosecuted legally, they would have been deemed to have acted in good faith. And in effect, it still leaves things open and loose. A few more stats for you, which is worth knowing about, I think, and they're on your handout, because often it's the really difficult, really painful, emotive situations that are brought up when we have discussions about abortion. But as we've seen, 98% are done under Category C, and 99.9% are those for the mental health of the mother. So only 1.6% were done for fetal abnormality. And that is Category E, where there's a substantial risk if the child is born, it would suffer from such a physical or mental abnormality as to be seriously handicapped. I put some conditions on your handout. 195 cases of anencephaly. Anencephaly is a desperate, desperately sad situation where a child would be born without a brain and life is impossible. Down syndrome, maybe some of you know children with Down syndrome, but there were 685 abortions because a child had Down syndrome last year. And there were 40 for cleft lip and palate. I suspect you know people with cleft lip and palate. It's a condition that's very easily treated shortly after birth. And some of us might struggle to see how that would be categorized as a serious abnormality. But anyway, it's there, and it's a relatively small proportion, but still, 40 abortions for cleft lip and palate. Only 0.05% were done to save the life of the mother or prevent her grave physical harm. And sometimes there will be a difficult choice for a medical team and the person they're caring for to make. And sometimes it would be necessary for there to be an abortion to save the life of the mother. There's also a 0.1% complication rate, but it's worth noting that most of those are not recorded because they only recorded when they happen in the clinic, and most abortions don't happen anywhere near a clinic, particularly these days. Let me just read you a story of a friend of mine called Monique. Our baby was called Anjou. She had Edwards syndrome, which is a chromosomal abnormality like Down syndrome, although very much worse. Only 5 to 10% of babies survive the first year. Anjou's problems were picked up first on a routine antenatal scan. I was happily married to Andy, and we already had a healthy 2-year-old daughter. Life was good, and we felt nothing could go wrong. The news about Anjou was devastating and led to the inevitable discussion with medics about terminating the pregnancy. After all, what's the point in continuing with the struggle and strife of a pregnancy where the child would not survive? But from the moment we heard the horrific news, Andy and I both felt we wanted to continue with the pregnancy and care for our daughter until she died. It was a gut response because we believed that God was in control and that this was a precious life that he had given to us to care for. Anjou was born on the 18th of March 2002, and 4 days later we took her home and cared for her until she died. We had an endless stream of visitors, many of whom cried as they held her. Sometimes it was for our pain, sometimes for theirs, such as the elderly lady who'd had multiple miscarriages and never had the opportunity to mourn. Anjou had the ability to reach deep into the lives of others, exposing pain and healing hurt. I grew up in South Africa, and around the same time, thousands of other African women were losing their babies, this time to HIV. We set up a charity that over the last 17 years has helped African children as well as her families. Anjou, tiny and helpless, lived for only 47 days, and yet she touched and changed the lives of many. The pain is still there, but what I find so miraculous is that out of something so hard, God can do something so beautiful. Next slide, please. When I was a GP, that was about 20-odd years ago now, most abortions were performed surgically under anaesthetic. The baby was manually, physically removed. Medical abortions were relatively rare. Medical abortions when people take pills rather than undergo surgery, but that has changed a lot. You can see in the graph on the left here. It shows a very definite trend. And most women these days will have a medical abortion. This involves taking 2 tablets a few days apart. One to block the pregnancy hormones and kill the fetus, and the second to cause the womb to contract so the fetus is expelled. There's no anaesthetic if done early. Relatively recently, women needed to be seen in clinics to be counseled, examined, and given the tablets. Although the abortion might itself end up happening at home, the process was basically clinic-based, and there was support around. But since COVID, things have changed. Temporary legislation was then passed, which meant that this can happen at home without going to the clinic at all. Telephone conversations would suffice and pills would be put in the post. And that temporary legislation has now become permanent. All this means that most abortions are being done at home and without support. The woman may not have told anybody. She's alone, contracting, bleeding, and the baby is flushed away into the toilet. My heart bleeds for the baby and for the woman. It was not how it was meant to be. So those are the facts and the figures that I wanted to share. And you may be wondering, how on earth did we get here? Over 1,000 a day, 1 in 3 women having an abortion by the age of 45. What has gone wrong? It's the next slide. I've depicted it like this, to indicate that it's complex and that issues feed off each other. There are forces behind this issue which just seek to keep the ball rolling. And just a few thoughts on some of this. There is external pressure. There can be enormous external pressure on women to have an abortion. Pressure from friends and family, even when well-intentioned. Phrases like, it's the sensible thing to do. How would you cope? It would be better for the child, even when it's blatantly not. There's financial pressure, there's career pressure. Most of us in this room are relatively well off and resourced, but others aren't. Poverty and social deprivation. What about the refugee community? Those who are here in this country illegally, not entitled to benefits, dependent on the will of men in their lives, without a real choice. Here are some quotes from women who, in the end, decided not to have an abortion. I was scared and ashamed. I didn't feel as if I had any control or choice. Lots of women feel they have very limited choice. He said he'd leave unless I got rid of it. Or I had been brought from India for an arranged marriage. My problem started when I became pregnant and the scan revealed I was expecting a baby girl. Deep cultural factors. How much choice did she have? Imagine the pain. There's internal panic. When women find they are pregnant unexpectedly, the first response is very often panic. I have never had an abortion, but there was a time when I thought I needed one. And I would have had one. It was just in the end I wasn't pregnant. Me, pregnant, my parents would have been devastated. This wasn't planned. What about my career? I was a junior hospital doctor at the time. I hadn't got time for a pregnancy, and a quick abortion would get things back on track. I could get one easily. I knew how to do that. That was my thinking. As soon as possible. That's often the woman's thinking. Sometimes the pressure is implicit rather than explicit. Here's the story of a woman who, in the end, decided to have an abortion. I was 19 when I went to university, and soon after I got there, I met my first boyfriend. I was madly in love, and after being with him for 6 months, I found out I was pregnant. This wasn't something I'd planned, and my reaction swung between, wow, this is amazing, and shh, mum's going to be mad. I really think there would have been a good chance of my keeping the child. An abortion wasn't inevitable. However, I'd never forgotten the way my mum had responded when my older sister, who wasn't married, got pregnant and had her son. She pushed her away, went on and on about how stupid she'd been. My dad, too. Well, that's her life over, he said. What will so-and-so think? We will never live this down. The shame they felt was palpable, and I was about to add to it. On top of that, my father had just retired on the grounds of ill health, and this was the last thing he needed, so I decided to have an abortion. It was not something I took lightly at the time. I think I knew it was wrong back then. Today, I'm sure I should never have done it, and I wish I hadn't. One way or another, the shame of it has hung over my life ever since. I'm now 46. Sometimes when I see a baby or a small child, I'm reminded of the child I might have had. I wonder what he or she would have been like. I could have been a grandmother by now. But despite regret and shame, I do have hope. When I am reminded of what I have done, and it was at the end of the day my decision, I remember that Jesus has died for me. He loves me, despite what I have done. I am completely forgiven. And for that, I'm very, very grateful. One day, I will meet him face to face. I'm also filled with hope that I will meet my child, because I know that God loved him or her, even though I chose not to. Pressure and panic are very, very real. And if we ever find ourselves walking alongside someone who is unexpectedly pregnant, the best thing we might be able to do for them is to encourage them to take time. Have those two things in mind, pressure and panic. You may well be doing her a favor by helping her slow down, take time, and make sure she's sure she's making the right choice. Then on that big ball, there is Genesis 3. Genesis 3 and the fall of humanity. The corruption that was caused at that time pervades this whole issue. From the devaluing of human life made in God's image to the twisted thinking that calls evil good, which is what the world does these days with abortion. And then there's the effect of the fall on the relationship between men and women. Men have far too often reneged on their responsibility to care for and protect women, particularly in the area of sexual intimacy and the commitment of marriage. They have wanted their cake and to eat it too. Women also have failed in their relationships with men. They've worshipped them, put them on a pedestal where they shouldn't be, happy to compromise to keep them, happy with sex without the commitment of marriage. God's ways in this world really are the best ways. While misogyny has played a part, feminism has too. There's been much that's been good about second feminism in the past, but second wave feminism took a turn which has been detrimental to women ever since. It tried, in order to achieve its goals for women in the workplace, to separate us, to free us from the burden of childbirth, separate us from our biologies, from our bodies. To do that is to reduce us as women, to make us something less than we are. As we remembered, we are made as God's men and women in God's image to fill the earth and subdue it. And there is something profoundly perverse going on here. We were meant to have children. As I said, it's not to undermine single women like me who've never had children, or to deny the many other wonderful things women have done, but to separate women from their purpose in such a fundamental way has been to dehumanize women. And then there are sex-selective abortions. In places like China and India, and also in this country, girls are being aborted simply because they are girls. In China, for instance, it's estimated that there are over 30 million fewer women than there should be. The one-child policy and sex-selective abortion are linked in this, which means that there are not enough wives for husbands, and the fear is that this will further fuel human trafficking from Vietnam and Cambodia. Abortion, which is promoted as being so good for women, is proving not so good for them after all. And it's worth noting that the consequences of abortion are not just individual and personal, but systemic and societal. The devil is having a field day. I've mentioned the 1967 Abortion Act, and ever since, the numbers of abortions have soared. It was introduced because of backstreet abortions and some agonizing stories about what was happening. But I don't expect those like Lord Steele, who introduced the bill, expected anything like this as a result. 270,000-odd abortions a year. Indeed, he has said as much himself in his later years. But it's here now, and change will be difficult, although not impossible. Denial is another significant factor, and we need to take our heads out of the sand, and hopefully this session today will help us to see what's going on. And you know, in the days of the slave trade and William Wilberforce, it was not until pictures were seen of the slaves and the conditions they lived in that change happened. And thank God it did. There are people today who believe that in the same way, we will not actually change anything to do with abortion until we see with our own eyes the reality of what's going on. That's why you sometimes see people campaigning with horrible pictures in the street or outside Parliament. They believe it's necessary for us to see these things, for things to change. If I'm to be honest with you, I struggle with some of those pictures. I'm not sure they're a fair representation of what's going on. They are often from surgical abortions rather than the more common medical abortions. So the fetus is more severely damaged. And they're often from late abortions, which are rare. Although they are what they are, and to that extent, true. I'm not sure they're really representative, but we need to be squeaky clean in this topic when squeaky clean in terms of integrity when discussing this topic, if we're going to have people listen to us. So I'm not going to show you pictures here today, but instead I am going to show you a picture of a model of a 12-week-old baby. Or it's not 12-week-old baby, it's 12 weeks in utero. 12-week fetus. At 12 weeks, the fetus is fully formed. Arms, fingers, toes, eyelids. Everything exists. Brain, spinal cord, heart, lungs. All other organs exist in miniature. All that needs to happen now is for it to grow, for the child to grow, and for things to develop fully. That's a 12-week fetus. So we've looked at the facts and figures, thought about some of the reasons we find ourselves in the position we do today. We've seen that these reasons are complex and multi-layered, cultural, legal, spiritual. We've seen, too, that it's a social justice issue, but it's also a pastoral one. And in each case, the pastoral situation is uniquely personal. So how should we respond to this situation? We start getting informed. Today's a good start. Start getting informed. We can pray. We can know where to get help. We can play our part in making our church as welcome a place as possible for those who are struggling. One of the things we do at St. Ebb's, where I come from, is we have leaflets like this at the back of church that just let people know about organisations who can help. People who are unexpectedly pregnant, have a discussion about what their options are, help them to see that abortion, which is so often seen as the obvious solution when a pregnancy is not wanted, is not the only option. And can also counsel people who are struggling as a result of a choice that they made early on in life. And I think there's some at the back here. So we can play our part in making our church as welcome a place as possible for those who are struggling in this area. We can get involved more practically. We should know where we stand, what our convictions are. Also what our personalities are. Some of us will be more pastoral and counselling orientated. Others of us will be more wanting to get change to happen, advocates for things. There's more information on the bottom of your handout. There's organisations there. Let me just run through some of those. Where's the handout? Yes, so I've listed there on the bottom of your handout some free, confidential, non-judgmental places you can go for help. Choices Charity, Life Charity, and Pregnancy Choices Directory. Right to Life for up-to-date political news. They'll send you emails. Sometimes it feels like a bit too many emails, but they will send you emails and keep you up to date with what's happening in Parliament, and you have opportunities then to write to your MP. I've done that a lot over recent years. It's important that our voices are heard. There's also some of what I've said today, just to flag up, does touch on issues around contraception and fertility treatment. And if you are someone who'd like to investigate that a little bit further, that's a brilliant book, Fearfully and Wonderfully Made, by Dr. Megan Best. And then I worked in South Africa for quite a long time, and I was very aware of some of the dynamics cross-culturally in the development world and international aid. And if you're interested in that kind of thing, you might like to read Target Africa. I thought that was just something a bit more left field that might spark some interest for some of you. But I think that's all I want to say at this stage. I realise I haven't fed into much of how we can help pastorally, and maybe some of that will come up in the Q&A. Each situation is very different, and we will all respond differently, but we've got to settle our convictions, act in compassion and prayerfully when we're walking alongside folk. Do what we can to help and support.